Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we speak with David McGowan about his photographic analysis of the Boston Marathon bombing. But first, let's look at some of the stories in other news. Here's one. Low vitamin D levels linked to disease in two big studies by Anahad O'Connor. It starts, people with low vitamin D levels are more likely to die from cancer and heart disease and to suffer from illnesses, scientists reported in two large studies. The new research suggests strongly that blood levels of vitamin D are a good barometer of overall health. But it does not resolve the question of whether low levels are a cause of disease or simply an indicator of behaviors that contribute to poor health. Okay, fine, but where do you get vitamin D? Well, it reads, as many know, vitamin D is produced in the body when the skin is exposed to sunlight. But it can be obtained from a small assortment of foods, including fish, eggs, dairy, organ meats, and mushrooms. And blood levels of it can be lowered by smoking, obesity, and inflammation. But some of the foods that you can grab it from, such as eggs and dairy, create inflammation in the body. So maybe that neutralizes everything there, and you're left with inflammation. Well, continuing in this article, a team of scientists at Harvard, Oxford, and other universities found persuasive evidence that vitamin D protects against major diseases. Adults with lower levels of the vitamin in their systems had a 35% increased risk of death from heart disease, 14% greater likelihood of death from cancer, and a greater mortality risk overall. Here it is. Here's a study. And the reason I point this out is, remember last year when we spoke to Dr. John Hall about the vitamin D levels in one of his patients who was in his mid-20s and basically worked outside. There was almost no vitamin D in this person's blood. How can this be? Well, we talked about that in this interview, but here is a clip of that particular part of the interview. Let's have a listen.
So those are really kind of the main symptoms, but usually you find it when people come in for a health check and, you know, your normal fasting blood sugar should be, you know, 100 or less, you know, and we're seeing, you know, 150, 200, 210, 300. And then you check their vitamin D levels, and they'll be non-existent. And the CDC has even addressed that the absence of vitamin D in the human population is at a national emergency. You know, we're checking a lot of people routinely for vitamin D now. And even people who work out in the sun all day long are coming in with zero levels of vitamin D. And vitamin D is a strong component of sugar metabolism in humans, along with heart function and brain function and memory. And it almost works more like a hormone or a cofactor than a vitamin.
That's what I heard.
Yeah, and if you put them back on some vitamin D3, and sometimes their sugar metabolism will normalize out, sometimes not. In my practice, mild type 2 diabetes or slight elevations in blood sugar, in the absence of D3 on testing, you know, we treat that with vitamin D3 and cinnamon. And usually, you know, can get the sugars back down to normal levels just with those two agents and not have to resort to one of the pharmacologics. The problem with the medicines that we're using pharmacologically or pharmaceutically for type 2 diabetes, it's kind of a double-edged sword with those. Yes, they control your sugar, but they also cause weight gain. So it ends up being a never-ending cycle. You bring the sugar down, but you raise the weight, which brings the sugar up. You need a little more medicine. It causes a little more weight gain. That brings the sugar up. You need a little more medicine. So I usually, at least in my practice, try to treat it naturally at first, unless I just absolutely can't bring it down with dietary change, replacement of vitamin D3, and cinnamon.
Oh, cinnamon. Is it organic cinnamon or any just?
Yeah, it's organic cinnamon. It comes in a capsule as a medical cinnamon. It's usually about 2,000 milligrams of cinnamon mixed with chromium in a capsule. And that's very common at most better vitamin stores.
That's really good information, Dr. Hall. Really appreciate that. Going back to that statement you made about the person being in the sun, working in the sun, but with almost zero vitamin D, Is that related to the saturation of electromagnetics in our environment?
Actually, it could be, but I also think that that might be from some of the aerial spraying. You know, you don't have to block the sun entirely to not stimulate the skin to produce vitamin D3. You just have to block the right frequency of light to do that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even though it may still appear to be a nice sunny day, if there's enough aluminum or whatever else they're spreading in the atmosphere up there to block that one frequency that those cells respond to, then they're not going to produce. I mean, that's the only logical explanation. I don't think over the last 50 years that humans have evolved to not produce D3. I think the right frequency of light is being blocked from us to be able to produce it.
I dug for information online about this. I couldn't find a thing. Is there any resource that you had looked at to come to some of these observations?
Not at all, Jeff. That's just my personal belief, because that's the only thing it can be. You know, I mean, that is how we produce vitamin D, is through the skin, and it is supposed to be produced with light exposure. So, I mean, I'm sure if you dug, you could probably find it somewhere. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, when you see people who are in their 20s, young and healthy, working as day workers or landscapers and in the sun all day, and they come in and they test with a zero vitamin D level, and I've seen that, zero vitamin D level, and they're sick, because when you run out of vitamin D, it affects everything. I mean, they come in, you know, no energy, I'm tired, my muscles hurt, you know, my memory's gone, you know, and I'm 25 years old, then there's something going on. And the only logical thing would be that we're not getting the right frequency of light to stimulate that production.
That was Dr. John Hall. He's the author of A New Breed, Satellite Terrorism in America. And we were talking about the body's ability of producing vitamin D from sunlight and the obstacles in the way. We talk a lot about the ability to use your instincts and common sense to assess photographic evidence. A frequent guest on this show, Dr. Judy Wood, had taught many to tune in to this valuable skill. We continue to do some investigation using these techniques in analyzing some of the high-definition images from the Boston Marathon bombing. On April 15, 2013, two pressure cooker bombs exploded at approximately 2:49 p.m. Three people were reported killed and an estimated 264 injured. The bombs exploded about 13 seconds and 210 yards apart. There were many high-definition images of the explosions and aftermath available to the public. Similar to the Sandy Hook shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, the speculation and alternative theories running counter to the official narrative saturate online media. Our guest, David McGowan, has posted numerous sets of images from the Boston Marathon bombing with captions describing inconsistencies on his website, The Center for an Informed America. He's the author of several books, including Programmed to Kill and Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. He joins us to talk about the photographic anomalies in the big picture of false flag events. David McGowan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Very happy to be here.
You've done some interesting investigative work into a number of events, including the Apollo moon landing, the assassination of JFK, and the September 11th, and much more. But we want to focus in this interview on the Boston Marathon bombing. And we know that the FBI has been using informants to entice innocent people into crime for quite a while. Examples are the Liberty 7 case, the Fort Dix case, and the Memorial Day weekend terror plot in upstate New York, just to name a few. For a number of people, it's not a big leap in understanding the federal government's involvement in maybe producing crisis actors amid a staged catastrophic event. Now, in your photo analysis of the Boston Marathon bombing, there are so many anomalies, and you notice people who should have been covered in blood and were not, and specifically the individual near the person with both legs that appeared to be severed below the knee. Can you tell us about that particular scene?
That's the Jeff Bowman guy who we are to believe had both of his legs traumatically amputated, and who was rolled off in a wheelchair and widely photographed and videotaped. Of course, those images were shoved in our faces to a pretty incredible degree after the event. Yeah, I mean, everything about him, as far as the photographic record is concerned, just does not add up. There were a number of people who claimed to have tended to him, and people in the photographs who could be seen around him. Yeah, there is a noticeable lack of blood on these people. You know, there was an incident in New York, I believe in December, where there was this weird freak accident where a taxi like jumped the curb and clipped off some woman, some tourist's foot. Actually, the car actually amputated her foot. And weirdly enough, one of the first guys on the scene was none other than Dr. Oz, famous TV doctor. I have a quote from him saying there was a very limited window that they had to save this woman's life, because when a leg or a portion of a leg is blown off like that, and he was quoted in the newspaper as saying, and I don't have it in front of me, but essentially what he said was, when that happens, that femoral artery is going to start spraying like a garden hose. And it's weird to believe that Jeff Bowman had both of his legs completely blown off, you know, like above the knee, or one just under the knee and one above the knee. Now, this woman just lost a foot, and we're being told that the blood would be spraying out like a garden hose, and you would have a very limited window to save her life, to stop that flow and save her life. And yet, this guy supposedly lost both of his legs, and the doctor who tended to him was this guy by the name of Dr. Painter, and who was interviewed quite a bit by the media afterwards. And you can see him in the pictures, you know, wandering among the alleged victims. And he had on, like, this bright yellow, dress shirt. And he did not even bother to roll up the sleeves, you know, of his shirt. And I think he had on, like, some khaki trousers or something. We're supposed to believe that this guy performed emergency triage on this guy who had just lost both of his legs blown off, and, you know, would have therefore been just spewing blood everywhere. And you can see in the pictures he did, in fact, tend to him to some degree. Walked away from that scene without so much as a speck of blood on him. Just spotlessly clean sleeves on his shirt, you know, no blood on his hands, no blood anywhere. And that was true of every single one of the responders. Every person who, you know, claimed to or can be seen in the images tending to these victims, they all walked away without a drop of blood on them. There was this another guy, Dr. Levine, who was like a doppelganger for Steven Spielberg. It's kind of uncanny in the images how closely he resembles Spielberg. But again, you know, this is a guy who tended to a number of victims, severely injured, you know, supposedly. Guy was wearing like a white jacket, you know, and same thing, walked away without a speck of blood on him. And every single one of the responders, I mean, I have pictures of all of these people, high-definition pictures of this whole scene unfolding, and there's not a single responder who walked away from that scene with, like, so much as even a drop of blood on them. And yet, we're told that something like 15 limbs were blown off that day in this very small, isolated patch of pavement. There were supposedly 15 limbs that were lost that day, which means, you know, the equivalent of like having 15 garden hoses spraying blood all over this scene. And yet every single person who gave aid or comfort to these victims walked away with no blood on them, you know. And that's just, there's just no way that that could have actually happened. It's also quite noticeable that none of the medical responders, the trained medical responders, the doctors, nurses, emergency personnel, paramedics, whatever, none of them took any kind of normal precautions that you would think that they would have taken when dealing with that much blood and the threat of bloodborne pathogens. A lot of them aren't even wearing gloves. Some of them are, but a lot of them aren't. And none of them, not a single person, can be seen wearing like eye protection or any kind of face protection, face mask or anything like that. Even though medical supplies were readily available, they had a very large, fully stocked medical tent just yards from where the blast went off at the end of the marathon route. And there were just scores of ambulances lined up. So there was no shortage of supplies, and yet none of these people, trained professionals, took the most basic precautions, you know. And I mean, we live in an era where my family dentist won't even drill my teeth without like putting on a hazmat suit, practically, you know. Wow. He wears eye protection and face mask and everything because there are real, very real threats. And yet these people were operating in a theater where, you know, 15 garden hoses were spraying blood all over the place. And that's in addition to scores of other people who suffered other grave injuries that fell short of amputation, but, you know, very serious injuries. And all these people are wandering around the scene without taking any kind of precautions to protect themselves from contamination. And all of them walked away blood free. That's just impossible for that to happen if this was in fact a real event.
There you go.
And if these were in fact real victims.
Good point.
And that's just one factor out of many, you know, the anomalies that can be detected in these images. But that is one of the main ones. I mean, that's a huge smoking gun right there. You know, how do you explain the fact that all of these people walked away without any blood on them, and none of them took any kind of normal precautions that a medical professional would normally take before entering into that scene?
So a glaring detail that you would think would be taken care of if it were a staged event, trying to convince people that the situation was real. So that's a very odd anomaly to look at. However, it seems if it were a staged event and these individuals were crisis actors that were involved here, they're relying on people not paying attention and being in panic mode. The photographic evidence, again, tells a lot. Many, many stories here, and it's trained people like yourself to be able to examine this and bring it forward, and courageous people too, because not many people are willing to take the risk to do this. So I got another question for you regarding the particular area that you focused in on, and specifically the two women. You did an interesting expose on investigating the images of the women who initially appeared side by side in a pool of red liquid, one with their legs sort of bent up unnaturally. What can you tell us about these women who were photographed a bit later on stretchers?
There was supposed to be Crystal Campbell and her friend, whose name was Karen Rand, I believe. The one image that showed that you're referring to, which shows the two of them in the foreground, their eyes closed, and was very widely circulated, and it was generally claimed that Crystal Campbell was actually deceased in the image, that she was that she had already passed, you know, because her eyes are closed. She looks very much like she could be, and her legs, as you said, are very unnatural angles. They look like one of them looks like it could possibly even be severed. As these pictures circulated, that was widely claimed, in fact, that the picture depicted her as deceased, and also that one of her legs was severed. And in fact, a lot of people were quite outraged at that picture, that think that image should be circulated, because it was widely believed that it did show her dead. But that's not actually the case, because there was another picture taken right after where her eyes are open and she's looking up at the the nurse that's tending to her, and in fact appears to be smiling, actually. And then there's later pictures of her on the stretcher with her legs having been magically restored and in a normal orientation, you know, and not showing significant injury. You know, there's blood and whatnot, but her legs are obviously intact and attached and not in the condition that they appear to be in that first picture. And that picture appears very much to have been posed. You look at the sequence of events, and one of the amazing thing about this incident that we have never ever had before, you know, including with Sandy Hook or any other high profile multi-victim incident that preceded it, is that we really have a complete pictorial record of this, almost like a second by second accounting of exactly what happened on that scene from moments after the detonation of the first explosive device until the final last of the victims had been taken away. We have like a complete photographic record of that. You know, all of the statements of the responders afterwards claim that she was, you know, the most seriously injured of the victims, that she was in traumatic arrest, that she was, you know, on the verge of death from you know, virtually the moment of explosion. And, you know, several people claim that, you know, they rushed to her aid first because she was obviously the most injured and that she was, you know, the first one tended to and gotten out of there and blah, 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 blah. All of which is just completely untrue. If you look at the photographic record, she was actually ignored for a considerable amount of time. The medical personnel were wandering around, just completely ignoring her, until this nurse happened over to her, which just happened to be at the same time that the photographer happened upon her. And that picture was just captured a very brief moment in time when this nurse and photographer just happened to converge on the scene there and sort of set up this scene and take the picture. And then the nurse immediately afterwards wandered off without showing any sign of concern, without notifying any of the doctors on the scene. You know, we're supposed to believe that she just tended to this woman who looks like she's dead, and whose legs look mangled and is obviously in need of immediate and urgent medical care. And yet after going and posing for that picture, that infamous picture, she just walked away like it was nothing. The photographer walked away, the nurse walked away, and neither one of them notified any, you know, hey, there's a girl over there that's like minutes away from death. You might want to go, you know. No, nothing. I mean, it's just, the official story just does not match up in any way, shape, or form with the photographic record at all. It's just remarkable, really, how blatantly obvious it is from the pictures that, you know, the Christo Campbell story that we were sold, it just doesn't hold water.
And it's another example of medical personnel behaving very oddly. You have the not taking precautions for contamination of blood, for example, and then just walking away from somebody in immediate need.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Dr. Painter, if you watch him and, you know, his movements can be tracked, like, you know, second by second, and wildly out of whack. His official statements on what he did do not conform in any way with the photographic record. The guy, he wanders on the scene slowly, kind of meanders over there, actually stops in for unknown reasons into the LensCrafter store before he even bothers to go over to the victims. Then he comes out, wanders over, walks right past Jeff Bowman, who's laying there on the ground with, you know, supposedly both legs blown off, walks right past an elderly man who's like, I don't know, in his 70s, 80 or something like that, who supposedly also lost a leg, walks right past Crystal Campbell, who was seconds away from death, walks right past all of these people, lingers around, then disappears from the scene again, then comes back on the scene, and then eventually he starts, you know, like tending to people. But even then, the first people he tends to are not the ones that, you know, are the media darlings of this event. You know, Jeff Bowman and Krista Campbell, the guy who lost both legs and the girl who lost her life. He continues to still ignore them and tend to other people with much less significant injuries. I mean, everything about his actions belies the notion that this was a real multi-victim, you know, traumatic incident. I mean, he's just not behaving the way a trained first responder would act in any way, shape, or form. So there's that.
Yeah, these are really critical anomalies to pay attention to. That start to paint a picture here that are consistent with other events that have occurred in the past couple of years, including Sandy Hook, the Sandy Hook shooting at Newtown School. This individual, Jeff Bowman, who had his legs blown off, and one of the main focuses in the mainstream media. Now, what have you found out about this individual in investigating some images that appear to be the same individual with both legs missing prior to this event?
The Bowman thing is a weird one. He absolutely had to have been an amputee prior to this event because, first of all, I mean, there's no way he would have lived through it. You know, I mean, the amount of time that he laid there on the ground unattended, you know, bleeding out. And yet, through it all, he not only didn't kill him. I mean, he didn't even lose consciousness, or lose the color in his skin and lips and whatnot, which is just bizarre for him to lay there for that amount of time, bleeding out, and then to be rolled out in a wheelchair of all things, still with his wounds undressed and fully exposed. And, I mean, the guy is still fully alert. He doesn't even really appear to be in a significant amount of pain. He doesn't appear to be in shock. He's fully conscious. He still has, you know, color. It's just, there's just no way that could possibly happen. I mean, just, you know, amazingly, not a single person passed out, lost consciousness. And I mean, you have like 15 people who supposedly lost a limb and all kinds of other people who suffered seriously traumatic injuries, and not one of them lost consciousness.
Ooh,
you know, every one of these people, as they were taken out, were fully conscious and alert and you know, camera ready, including Jeff Bowman. And I mean, for him to not even have lost consciousness is just, it's mind-boggling. I mean, both physically and psychologically. I mean, how do you look down and see that where your legs just were a second ago are now just these bony, bloody protrusions? It's just inexplicable to me and to you know, there are numerous other people who have studied these images, how that could possibly be a real human response to having had both of your legs blown off. And there's a video that I posted, a couple of videos actually, that show training scenes where professionally trained crisis actors, many of whom are amputees, are hired and used in drills for training purposes to expose first responders to what is, you know, considered to be as close as possible to real-world conditions. So they use these what they call crisis actors, who are oftentimes amputees, who, you know, have lost a limb or one or more limbs, you know, somewhere at some point in their lives. Many of them are military veterans, you know, but they are now fully healed, but they are made up to look as if their wounds are new and fresh and very realistically done. And I've seen some of these training videos, and the responses of these actors who are trained by, you know, military professionals and medical professionals that have experienced real-world conditions and know how people actually respond to the, you know, traumatic loss of a limb, And you see these actors on these in these videos, and they are acting nothing like the people in Boston. I mean, these people are just writhing in pain. Some of them are in just so much pain and fear that it takes 2 to 3, you know, military personnel to hold them down and keep them steady enough that somebody else can then begin to administer first aid to them. They are behaving the way a person would actually behave in the real world if suddenly, out of the blue, both of their legs suddenly got blown off. And the people in Boston were not. You see these people, and they're just sitting around casually, kicking back, you know, just, I mean, they look like they're just out, you know, to watch a parade or something. They don't look like people that have just had a leg blown off and are waiting for medical attention. You know, they're just perfectly calm. No indication from their actions that these are real injuries.
Our guest is David McGowan, and we're talking about a photographic analysis of the Boston Marathon bombing. We'll be right back after this break. Interesting. Our guest, David McGowan. We're talking about the high-definition photographs of the Boston Marathon bombing and David's analysis.
It's difficult to comprehend how this could be orchestrated, and some people could actually seriously be injured, and others are actors amid non-actors. It's very confusing, and that's probably by design, but David, I wanted to get your assessment, since you've been investigating this fairly deeply, your assessment on what you think is really going on here, what's behind this particular event, and if it indeed was a false flag, for what?
Well, I think one of the main purposes is to condition us to accept an ever more overt form of the police state. You know, a big section of Boston was essentially placed under martial law, and you know, the images that came out of there were just terrifying. Of, you know, these heavily armed troops rolling through the streets of Boston with armored personnel carriers and attack helicopters and fully automatic weapons, and conducting no-knock searches of people's homes, and you know, basically ordering people to shelter in place, and just. I mean, they put that city on lockdown, you know, to go after a couple of kids, supposedly, who between the two of them had like one handgun, you know, if the official story is to be believed. And that required, you know, putting the entire, you know, a huge portion of the city under martial law, under lockdown. I mean, it was just mind-boggling, the degree of, you know, unrestrained police force that was turned loose there. And that's happened several times since then in events that appear to be equally staged. You know, it's happened twice right here in my own neck of the woods here in L.A., once with the Christopher Dorner incident, where the entire resort town of Big Bear and Arrowhead were placed under martial law, and it was pretty much the same thing. They rolled in the armored personnel carriers, the body armored cops with automatic weapons, the helicopters, you know, every piece of military equipment they could get their hands on, and ordered people to, you know, basically imprison people in their homes and did no-knock searches. The same thing. after the LAX shooting here more recently, which again appeared to be a completely staged, fabricated event that led directly to a limited state of martial law. It's a conditioning exercise to get us so used to that that eventually we'll think nothing of seeing an armored personnel carrier full of heavily armed troops, you know, rolling down our residential streets. Even if you believe the official stories, it's hard to see how these most recent police responses are in any way proportionate to the actual threat. You know, in the Christopher Dorner case, they were chasing one guy, and they put half the damn state under martial law, practically. You know, in Boston, they were chasing a couple of teenage kids, you know, and in the LAX, they already actually had the guy in custody almost immediately, and yet still, you know, placed a huge chunk of the city under martial law. You know, these are wildly out of proportion responses, even if we accept that the official stories are true, which they don't appear to be. Oh, and there was another one, actually, in Santa Monica College, another one that appeared to be a staged event that was also followed by massive police mobilization. So, I mean, that seems to be the program now, is they stage a provocation and then follow it up immediately with this massive, overwhelming, ridiculous police response. And we are supposed to accept that now as the new normal, as what is necessary to keep us safe and protect the great American way. And I think that is a huge part of it. And as to why they're using crisis actors to do this rather than real victims, because, you know, it's not like their government has any real moral qualms with actually killing and maiming people. I believe if these were real amputees, they would not be behaving in any way, shape, or form like the people who came out of Boston, who have become sort of these media darlings and who were photographed within days, sometimes hours, of being injured, you know, sitting up in their hospital beds with a smile, grinning from ear to ear, and, you know, hopping around on their new prosthetics within, like, days. And the whole healing process that these people went through was so wildly off from what is the norm, you know, both physically and psychologically. Normally, losing a limb it's been compared to losing a very close family member. It's like suddenly and unexpectedly losing a spouse or a child. You know, it's something that's an integral part of your life that's just been taken away unexpectedly and is never coming back. And normally there's a whole multi-stage grieving process that goes on with, you know, a great deal of depression and anger and bitterness and resentment and confusion and anxiety and just a whole massive emotions, and suicidal thoughts and suicide attempts are not at all uncommon following a traumatic amputation. And, you know, it's a healing process that can take years to go through for most people. But these people were, like, making public appearances, smiling and just as happy as could be in their, you know, in their new legless state within, like, just, like, days of the incident. And that is not normal. That is not the way that amputees would normally respond. And my best guess is that they're doing it that way because it allows them to control not just the situation, but the aftermath and how it's sold to the public and used to implement their agenda.
Right. They're banking on the fact that people aren't going to pay attention to details. And what is your assessment of that, the public being easily persuaded or deceived, but it's still a comment on the hypnotic state that people are in?
Yeah, it does seem to be pretty easy to fool most of the people most of the time. Yeah, I mean, they don't even have to cover their tracks, it doesn't seem like, nearly as well as they used to, or come up with as credible a cover story. You know, I mean, these As soon as one of these incidents occurs, whether it's a school shooting or you know, the Boston Marathon bombing or the ridiculous attack that supposedly happened in Woolwich, England, just after the marathon, people start shooting holes in the official story. You know, I mean, they just don't hold up at all anymore. And, you know, I mean, every aspect of the Boston stories of the pursuit of the brothers and supposedly killing one and capturing the other in the boat and the friend of theirs that was, you know, basically summarily executed by the FBI in his own apartment. Every aspect of the story generally falls apart pretty quickly these days once it's subjected to any kind of scrutiny, but it doesn't really seem to matter because 90% of the people buy it anyway, you know, and just consider those of us who are trying to raise awareness to just be a bunch of kooks. You can consider me a kook all you want. You can completely disregard all the commentary that I have to make, but I defy anyone to go through my website and look at all of the 200 plus images that I have posted from Boston and tell me that we were not sold a huge bill of goods there, because the photographic record does not in any way, shape, or form conform to what we were told happened, you know, and that's regardless of what me or anyone else has to say about it. Just look at the pictures yourself. If you do so with a halfway open mind and put your biases aside, you're going to be shocked by what you find there.
Can you tell listeners what your website is so they can take a quick visit?
My website's called the Center for an Informed America. It is at www.davesweb.cnchost.com, which is kind of a mouthful, but if you Google my name, either Dave McGowan or David McGowan, it generally comes up as the first link or one of the very first ones.
Now, David, you have a very interesting book coming out amid your other three books, but this one, another heavy topic. And tell us what this is.
It is about the Laurel Canyon music scene of the late 1960s and early 1970s, which a handful of mainstream books have looked at in the last 8-10 years. Before that, it was largely unexplored territory, but which is kind of weird because, you know, when people think of the 60s and the hippies and the flower children and the music that came out of that era and that whole sort of countercultural scene, 99.9% of the time they think immediately of Haight-Ashbury up in San Francisco. And that is, you know, pretty much universally viewed as the center of the hippie, the birthplace and the center of the hippie universe. Which actually isn't true. It actually began right here in L.A. in Laurel Canyon a couple of years before it migrated up north to San Francisco. And the scene here was much bigger and involved a lot more bands and actually preceded and inspired that scene. So, you know, Laurel Canyon should actually rightly be viewed as the center of the hippie universe. But it's only been very recently that that's begun to be kind of told in a mainstream way. And my book looks at the darker kind of side of that scene and kind of asks the question of, you know, was it really the organic grassroots resistance movement that we were supposed to believe it was? And was it really a movement that was all about, you know, peace, love, and understanding? Because there was an incredibly violent backdrop to that, a violent and bloody backdrop to that scene, and a whole lot of intelligence connections going on with the people and places involved. So my book kind of takes a much darker turn than other books that have covered that ground, and will not be well received in certain quarters, I'm sure, but it's a work that I'm very, very proud of, and that began life as a web series that kind of took on a life of its own and became wildly popular. And now that it has been turned into a book, there's been quite a bit of buzz, actually, around the release. And I'm hoping that it's going to do much better than my previous books, which haven't done all that well. Yeah, it's a book that I spent 6-7 years working on, and spent the last year working with a publisher and fine-tuning the manuscript, and I've added a whole lot of new material, so even the people who read it on the while it was a work in progress on the internet, there's a whole lot of brand new material. I think there's like 6 new chapters, a new preface, a new foreword. There's a complete bibliography now. It's all indexed for easy reference.
Excellent. Well,
this is my first book in 10 years, actually. My last one, I wrote 3 of them in fairly quick succession. I think the first one came out in 2000, I want to say, and the second one around 2001 or 2002, and the third one in 2004, and got very discouraged with the whole book industry, and have just done all my work on the web since then. So this is my first actual published work in a full decade, so I'm very excited about it, and cautiously optimistic that it's going to do well for me.
I have a good feeling that it will. And David, I want to have you on back on the show to talk specifically about that book. I noticed that some of the images of the victims in Syria, there's a similar anomaly there, where some of these people were supposedly killed by biological weapons, and their faces still seemed plump, and muscle tone was rigid, and as if their hearts were still beating. And that's something you mentioned a bit on some of the faces of these people who had lost a lot of blood. There's a specific look to their face. If you're not paying attention, you won't see it. Can you explain that a little bit more in detail to listeners?
All these people left the scene fully conscious. They did not look like people who had just suffered major, you know, I mean, I don't know how to explain it in technical terms other than to say that they do not strike me as people who have just experienced a major, literally life-changing trauma. They just look like people going about their normal everyday lives, you know, and they don't appear to be in shock. They don't appear to have suffered significant blood loss. They don't show signs of that. They don't appear to be, you know, they're all conscious. They don't show signs of being on the verge of losing consciousness. They just, in no way, shape, or form do these people look like what you would think. And some people say, well, you're just, perceptions are warped from Hollywood, you know. We just, you know, you expect everything to look like it does in the movies and stuff, but that's not actually true, you know. I mean, in comparison with other real tragedies and whatnot, these images and these people's actions and their expressions and everything about them, their demeanor and their posture and everything else, just it just does not add up to, you know, to the injuries that we were told that they sustained, you know. And I mean, some of them can actually be seen walking around. As you know, there's this one guy, Michael, I can't remember the name, who supposedly ended up in the hospital and, you know, got all kinds of money paid to him based on his injuries and you know, had fundraising drives. And that's another thing. These people have been very, very well compensated, both through the official victims fund and through their own fundraising efforts that they've done. These people have raised a lot of money for supposedly their pain and suffering.
In fact, Sandy Hook, a similar situation there. They allegedly, I heard, $17 million was raised, and every parent got a big chunk of that money. No lawsuits were filed by the parents against the school. Eric Holder gave police officers involved a big check. And some of the people didn't have to pay taxes for the next 10 years. So tell us about the money involvement with the Boston Marathon bombing.
Yeah, the money that was paid out to these people, yeah, it was very odd. I mean, the speed, first of all, it was distributed to them, like, remarkably quickly. This fund was set up and then distributed, and, you know, based on severity of injury, how much they got. But everybody got something. And a lot of them got just massive amounts of money based on injuries that do not appear to actually exist. I mean, like I say, people that were up walking around looking like they didn't have a mark on them, later, you know, pocketed hundreds of thousands of dollars for their injuries. So, yeah, there was a huge, huge payout. And it was given to them with tax-free. First of all, they didn't have to pay any taxes on these windfall profits. And strangely enough, they were not required to sign any kind of release. Normally in the past, when people receive a payment like that, they have to sign a release basically saying that they are accepting that as full and final payment for their injuries and they will not file any additional lawsuits. And these people weren't even required to do that. They were just handed the money. Here you go, tax-free, no strings attached. You don't have to sign anything. We're just giving it to you. You can go ahead and sue us if you want. And, I mean, that is just highly unusual for that money to be dispersed that quickly and with no strings attached, tax-free. I mean, just this huge windfall, no strings attached profit that these people received. And like I say, many of them, based on these photos, did not receive the injuries that these financial settlements were based on. And then they were allowed, even encouraged, to set up their own fundraiser, you know, some of which raised up to, I think Bowman raised like over $1 million just on his own, in addition to the millions that he was paid from the state fund. And he's getting all kinds of personal appearance money. I mean, the guy pops up everywhere, sporting events, and him and Carlos have become like the tag team on the personal appearances, which I'm sure they're pocketing massive, you know, appearance fees for. So these people are cashing in a huge, huge way, in ways that, you know, normally would take years for this money to work its way through the bureaucracy, and then there would be all kinds of strings attached to it and whatnot. And instead, it was just almost instantly these people were paid off in just staggering amounts of money.
It is remarkable, and let's also remember that the legislation trying to be pushed through after these events, a successful false flag usually has legislation ready to be rolled out behind it and to be passed.
The response is always ready before the event. It's always pre-scripted. You know, they always know exactly how they're going to respond to these things. And even if you find a hard time accepting that the government is staging these events, they certainly are exploiting them to an extreme degree to advance an agenda. You know, at the very least, you know, I would hope that people would be able to see that. But, you know, as we said earlier, unfortunately, a lot of people still don't have their eyes open. And they believe everything that they're told and everything that they read. And, you know, if it's on Fox News, then half the country believes it. And if it's on CNN or MSNBC, the other half believes it, you know.
Indeed. David McGowan, whose website is the Center for an Informed America. You can type that into a search engine and find his website. David is also the author of the book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops in the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream, a fantastic book that, David, we're going to have you back on to talk about that.
I'd love to. There's a Facebook page. If you're on Facebook, if you put in Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, you can pull up the Facebook page, which has a lot of photographs that were not included in the book, that originally accompanied the original web post. So if you want to get the visuals to go with the book, you can find them there, and different comments that people have made about it and whatnot, information about the release and all of that sort of stuff will all be on there, and it will be kept updated.
Fantastic. David McGowan, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. See you next week, Monday, 10 p.m.
We'll be right back.